It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, filling in today for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, have you reread a good book lately? Our guest says we should take time to revisit some of our favorite books.
First, this weekend, Kraft Foods recalled 96,000 pounds of hot dogs after their call was received from a consumer to alert them that there was cheese in what were labeled as normal Franks.
The dogs were labeled Oscar Mayer Classic, but were actually classic cheese dogs. The mix-up has caused what they call a Class 1 recall. It's used when there is a reasonable probability that the use of the product will cause serious adverse health consequences or death, mainly because of the risk of allergic reaction.
The hot dogs were distributed nationwide and are estimated to be limited to about 8,000 cases of the product.
Here with us to explain how this may have happened and what's involved in this kind of recall is Andy Milkowski. He's adjunct professor in the Meat and Muscle Biology Lab at the University of Wisconsin. He's a former fellow at the Oscar Mayer Division of Kraft Foods. Welcome to Central Time.
Well, I'm pleased to join you.
Well, looking at this recall, literally tons of hot dogs, 96,000 pounds, it sounds like a lot, but in the scope of American meat production and consumption, is this a big recall?
It's good size, but it's not huge. That's about 100,000 pounds, but on an annual basis, consumers eat probably... hundreds of millions of pounds of hot dogs a year.
Wow. Okay. So significant, but not an earth-shaking event here. Now, as we mentioned, these are hot dogs that had cheese, were not labeled with cheese, so they're a risk of dairy allergy. Are there checks in place at most manufacturers, quality control, to make sure that sort of thing doesn't happen?
Certainly. There are cross-checks when you take labels out of supply and put them on a line to put on packages. Obviously, in this case, there was a mistake made.
This was a result of a call we hear from a consumer on April 18th, last Friday, and they were on track with trying to recall them the next day. Are consumers usually the first ones who detect problems that end up resulting in a recall?
Not always. It goes across the board. Sometimes the company will discover the mistake, and they certainly go through their internal analysis and then notify the USDA, Food Safety Inspection Service, when they've found something like that, and then they work together and figure out what they're going to do. And if a recall is warranted, then they'll start a recall.
And do we know what happened in this case, how so many hot dogs weren't labeled appropriately?
I really don't know. I could tell you that from the outside, the hot dogs would look identical. So the cheese is on the inside of the hot dog, so it wouldn't be noticeable on a packaging line. So in some way, they put the wrong labels on the labeling apparatus on the packaging line, and it wasn't visually apparent for those, you know, that they weren't correct, and therefore they went out the door.
Turning from the initial problem to the recall, the turnaround time, was this resolved in a pretty quick, responsible way, do you think?
Sure. Yeah. Within 24, 48 hours of finding out something like this, the company acted appropriately.
Is that the norm, or do we usually see a longer lag?
It is always dependent on the situation. I think in this case, with it being an allergen and a review of the records, the company went to the federal regulators and told them about it, and they immediately initiated the recall.
Is that standard operating procedure that you're supposed to do if you're a company in this situation, start off with a call to the USDA?
Yes.
Now, what are the risks we're talking about? Now, happily, this isn't a case of a contaminated product, salmonella or something like that, but as you mentioned, allergens can be a serious risk. What would be the concern here?
Well, if someone is acutely sensitive to dairy proteins and they could have a severe allergic reaction, that's certainly a health risk. in most cases, with dairy proteins, the allergic response is probably a bit more mild, but nevertheless, dairy proteins are considered allergens, so you would act as if it could be a severe problem.
So people out there, hot dog fans who have a serious dairy allergy would be the target group that would be concerned about this. What action do they take? What do they watch out for?
Well, they would look at the ingredients listed on a label or the labeling of a product. So in this case where you had a hot dog with pieces of cheese in it, those are dairy proteins in there. And because it had the wrong label on it, you wouldn't know that.
But with a recall, is there a place somebody can go and say, hey, I want to know if this package of hot dogs is part of the recall? Where can they turn for that kind of info?
Well, there are a variety of venues to do that. First, all of the public announcements. You could call the company. They certainly would tell you. You could go to the USDA website. And the recall is listed there along with pictures of the labels, the correct label and the wrong label.
And this is a Class 1 recall, I gather. What does that mean?
Okay. Well, recalls are divided into three types. Class 1 is considered to be a severe potential health hazard, and a Class 2 would also be a product where there could be a health consequence. And then a Class 3 would be a lesser severity and therefore wouldn't be a lower level of concern.
Now, once all these products are out the door, they're in stores, obviously in the hands of consumers now, how many products usually come back when they're recalled, when the information gets out there?
I don't know. I think it's pretty variable.
Just based on how widely the information gets out there, and I guess how closely consumers are paying attention.
Yeah, and how quickly it's caught. So in this case, these products were made in, I believe, early March, if I recall. And so how many had been consumed already without any impact, you're obviously not going to obtain those back.
What kind of cost can this put on a company trying to get this recall turned around?
In this case, I'm sure it's quite expensive. It's in the millions.
Looking at our food recall system in general, do you think we have a good system in place, or are there changes you might like to see to protect safety, to turn things around a little faster?
Well, I think the system we have today is pretty good. I mean, you have ethical companies who are looking to do the right thing. And obviously, they don't want to make these types of mistakes. But if they happen, they have systems in place to investigate and take the appropriate action. And if it's a recall, then they're not hesitant to do that.
All right. Andy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Andy Milkowski, adjunct professor in the Meat and Muscle Biology Lab at the University of Wisconsin. We've been talking about Kraft's recall of 96,000 pounds of mislabeled hot dogs. The world is packed with good books to read and not enough time to read them all. So is it ever worthwhile to reread books? Our next guest says we should make the time, and we want to hear from you, too. Is there a book you keep going back to again and again, or something you want to read? It's there on the shelf, but you just haven't made the time for it. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Clay Risen joins us now. He is an author and editor at the New York Times op-ed section, and we have posted his recent piece on rereading on the Central Time Facebook page. Clay, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, I just reread your piece on the rereading, so there we go with that. But it's interesting because you sort of chronicle your life a little bit, and when you were younger, when you were a child, when you were a young reader, you reread all the time, and you had this fixation. I don't know if I want to call it a fixation or an obsession, but you liked the Hardy Boys an awful lot.
Yeah. Well, like a lot of young boys, I enjoyed those books. And, I think, I enjoyed going back and sort of communing with the characters. And it's something that I feel in some ways that I've lost as an adult.
And you mentioned that very specifically, like you were in your early 20s, maybe in college or something like that. And what happened? The time just started taking.
Yeah. I think with a lot of people, time starts to run away from you. And you really, in my case, at least, started to pay more attention to, kind of the wide world of books out there. And I started to accept a trade-off that said, in order to read broadly, I need to sort of cut back on rereading. And pretty quickly, that combined with just not having enough time meant that I haven't reread a book in years.
And I was thinking about this because while I was reading it, I know people who are rereaders, and I know people who are not. And the world can be neatly divided up between those two groups, I think, because the rereaders go back to old favorites, and it's sort of like going back to old friends, and there's a certain comfort there, and you see nuances and so forth. And the people who don't reread tend to fall in the camp of there's so much to read, and if I reread something, I'm missing something else. Is that sort of the way you see it?
Well, I think that's right, but I would like to think that I fall into something of a third category, which is people who don't reread who, on a certain level, really wish they did and can really appreciate the joys and the value of rereading, and yet for one reason or another can't. I think it's part of our modern condition that we're exposed to so much media out there, and I don't think people are overly obsessed with sort of the minute-to-minute things that are out there. I think people have the capacity to sit down and read something at length, but the fact is that we don't for whatever reason, and except for, like you said, some people who really do have that capacity to sit down with a book that they've already read and go back through it.
And you've been thinking about this a lot because let's just bring your daughter into all of this, because you've been reading to her and thinking about kind of how she views the world at her young age and how the world has then changed for you at your advanced age.
Yeah, I would say, this wasn't something that I'd given a lot of thought to until she came along. And I think I was aware that I didn't reread as much as I used to. But with her, as I started to read to her really in the last year and a half or so, I've noticed that she's very, like all children, who really wants to go back time and again to the same books, often maybe read the same book two or three times in a sitting. And for her, the experience is so different. And I found this a very illuminating way to look at what maybe I had lost in growing up. For her, it's very much about an extension of reality. I mean, I don't think that for a lot of children, they see this bright line between what they read about and the kind of characters that they engage with in their mind and what they see in the outside world. And in some ways, it's a much richer world than we live in. And it makes for a very exciting experience to go back to the same story over and over again.
We're talking with Clay Risen about the idea of rereading books that we have read in the past. Maybe it's a book that we loved. Maybe it's a book that we didn't understand the first time. We want to go back and try and figure it out. We'd like to hear from you, too. What books would you like to go back and reread? What books do you go back and reread? Or don't you have the time to make all of that happen? 800-642-1234 is our number if you'd like to join in the discussion. 800-642-1234. Let's begin hearing from some of our listeners, and we start with Mireille from Minocqua.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Well, hi. I found it interesting because I always thought I was strange, but when I have no books in my waiting list that grabs me at the time, I reread things such as certain classic Anna Karenina. I reread, and anything by Steinbeck, East of Eden, or recently reread Hero.
And Mireille, unfortunately, you're breaking up there, so we weren't able to hear anything. But But Tony or Clay, what we were hearing there was a lot of classics. We heard Steinbeck, Anna Karenina, which I can't even say all of a sudden. but you get my drift.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing that I thought was, and I didn't put this in the article, but I've thought about since, is, you know, it's funny. I guess it comes down to a matter of time, but we go back to music all the time. You know, classic music or things that we consider our own sort of canon, whatever we personally define that as, whether it's old rock music or stuff from our childhood or classic jazz, and we go back to it over and over again, often the same recordings. And yet we don't do that as often with books. I mean, some people obviously like the caller, they do, but I think certainly I don't. And I've been sort of thinking about, you know, why is that? Why do we not go back? And is it just because there's this sort of static element to the page that maybe you don't find with music? You know, I don't want to say everyone's like this, but I think that's a fairly common experience for adults. And yet, as I said, you know, not so much for children.
Well, and what about this? As you were mentioning that, I was thinking about, you know, going back and listening to, you know, a classic jazz album or something I loved when I was young and thinking, you know, I do that. But generally speaking, I do tend to go back and listen to things that in my old age now, I think have more weight, are sort of worth back going and back and listening to, or worth taking time to go back and read. And, and what about that? I mean, is there room in all of this for something that maybe isn't so heavy, that's not so weighty, that I just liked at one time for no good reason, a guilty pleasure maybe?
Oh, I think absolutely. I would make the case that everybody, certainly I will, having written this and having spent time with my daughter, make more of an effort to go back and reread things that, like you said, are touchstones for me, whether or not they're big, weighty books or lighthearted books or books that I enjoyed as a child. I mean, to go back and get back in touch with those, and even though it'll be, in a way, sort of retreading old ground, I think that you find a lot of things that maybe you missed the first time or that you just haven't considered in sort of light of present day.
Let's go back to the calls. We've got a lot of listeners who would like to join in. Sarah starts us off from Milwaukee. Hi. Hi, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to call in and say that I am an English professor in Milwaukee, so I do a lot of rereading. But one of the things that I do the most is that I read the Chaim Potok's The Chosen.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that book, and I also reread, Philip Roth's American Pastoral several times as well, and it just keeps getting better every time I read it.
And Sarah, thanks for that call. And Clay, you know, there we are again, more classics in there, and it's interesting because the way she phrased it is she makes appointments, it sounds like, to read these books on almost an annual basis.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great idea. I think you know, we often, or at least I feel like, you know, I'm presented with a smorgasbord of options out there, and it's worth the effort to sit down and say, well, what are the books that, for me personally, are worth going back to, not just once or twice, but, you know, once every year or once every couple of years, just to sort of dip back in. And I think that that's the kind of book where it has to be something that not only speaks to you at the moment, but has an obvious depth to it that is going to just provide a bounty every time, is something new, a new bounty every time you go back to it.
And Grace from Madison might have one of those books for us. Hi, Grace.
Hi. I was just going to say, I reread The Stranger by Albert Camus because I find with existential themes, it can really mean something different depending on your stage of life.
Grace, thanks for that call. And Clay, there's one of those books.
Yeah.
I mean, we all read it in college or in high school. And then if you pick it up 20 years later, all of a sudden, that's one of those books that looks awfully different.
I think that's right. Although, you know, I would also say it's all of this is still somewhat different than the kind of experience, the sort of fundamental experience that I see in that I remember having when I was a child, and that that my daughter has. It's not so much a reflection as much as a pure just grappling with the characters and the storyline. You know, it's a fine distinction, and I don't mean to criticize or denigrate at all the reasons why people go back to books. But, you know, I do think that there is something, some way that children read and reread obsessively that is very different from the way that most adults do, and is one reason why most adults don't go back to books over and over.
Yeah, I would almost characterize it as when you're a child, you're sort of in the moment.
Yeah, well, that's very much it. I mean, I think it's an extension of the way that children view the world in general. They enjoy, how many parents haven't had this experience where they just get, they see their children doing the same thing over and over. It's this repetition that, it's enjoyable in and of itself, but it's also just this newness for a child that that they're rolling through. And I think, I don't know how many books I've read, but, hundreds or thousands or whatever.
And we'll have to leave it there. We've got to take some time out for news, but we will be back. We're talking to Clay Risen about the joys of rereading books and the value of making time for rereading in our lives.
And you can call us and tell us what you reread or what you would reread if you had time at 800-642-1234. We continue our conversation now with author Clay Risen about rereading books and why we don't always make time to do it.
You can join in, too. We'd like to hear from you. What books have you reread? Is that time, is that effort all worth it? And what's on your list of books to reread if you haven't quite gotten around to it yet? Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can also post your comments, post your list to the Central Time Facebook page. Let's go to the phones right away. We've got listeners who would like to join in. Steve is with us from La Crosse. Hi.
Hi.
You're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I tend to read books that are parts of series. And recently, with the George R. R. Martin Song of Ice and Fire series, I know most of your guests have been talking about classics, but I've reread each book every time a new one has come out. So when book three came out, I read one, two, and then three, and so on.
And so you'll keep doing that into infinity, do you think, or?
Until the series is over, yeah.
All right, that's a new one. I had not heard of that. Steve, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Dan from Menominee. Hi.
Hi there. So I think there are probably two main reasons people reread. One is that there are books that are just so incredibly rich in detail, and really anything by Neal Stephenson jumps to mind, like Reason D or Cryptonomicon. And then there are some books that are just so much unabashed fun. I'm thinking here of Jim Butcher, who wrote the Dresden Files series. You can tear through one of those in 6 hours, and it's kind of like watching your favorite TV show all over again. So highly recommended.
Dan, thanks for that call. We sure appreciate it. And Clay Risen, let's go back to and recap some of those calls there. We had the first caller, the Ice and Fire series. He rereads the whole series starting from one every time a new book comes out in that. And
wow.
I like that. That's dedication. Yeah. But, it gives you that sense of the overall arc of the work, I think, and it kind of keeps you in that moment. But I also like Dan's comments, too, about the books that have a lot of detail and going back over those, because a lot of people, like me, for example, read fast and we get the gist of things, but you miss that detail.
I think that's right. I agree completely. And I think that is a lot of what draws people back to books, is that specific authors with just a great eye for detail. I mean, some authors know that that's what they're putting into their books, that there are things that are going to maybe be missed on that first pass. And so they're rewarding readers who go back and take the time to give it a second pass or a third pass, or in the first caller's probably an infinite number of passes, depending on Martin's productivity.
Amy joins us now from Appleton. Hi, Amy.
Hello.
You're on the air.
Hi. I was thinking as I was listening to your messages that one of the things that I find myself doing, of course, I reread numerous things, especially two books every year. One is To Kill a Mockingbird and the other is Little Women. But what I find myself doing with other books that obviously my list is usually 20 books long at a time, I find myself going back to books that I love and rereading my favorite parts.
Oh, so like a certain chapter or a certain passage?
I do. I go in with the intent that I'm going to read the whole thing, and then I go back and I'm like, oh, I just really love this part, and I go back to it, and then I go to the next part and read that part.
Like sort of the Reader's Digest condensed version, as make it up as you go along. Amy, thanks for that. Now, Clay, I hadn't heard that method before.
No, but that's a great idea. That's a real way to sort of split the difference. And if you don't have the time to go back to a full book or to read a book in full, keep in mind what your favorite parts are, or parts that aren't your favorites. You know, try to go back, and if it's a book that you think is really compelling, but maybe there's a part you don't like, give that a shot. Maybe there's something new to be found there.
And if it really is compelling, you're going to wind up reading the whole thing.
Well,
anyway.
Yeah, right.
So there you go. Colin is with us now from La Crosse. Hi.
Hi there. I kind of do what Amy said, actually. When I listen or when I read the things they carried, I like to go back and pick out chapters. It's kind of fun. But I find myself, as I get older, just getting drawn to the old raw adventure stories I like to read. One of my favorites was Into the Wild. And then there's another book by Andrew Schwab called It's All Downhill from Here, about a rock musician, and just all the crazy hijinks they get into. And I find energy from reading those sorts of books over and over again.
Colin, thanks for that call. We appreciate your insight. And if we've got other listeners who'd like to join in, 800-642-1234. Crystal is with us from Humbird now. Hi.
Hi. I have a six-book series that I really like to reread. It's by Jane Aul, The Earth's Children. It takes place in the Ice Age, and it's really super interesting, and a lot of it is very factual. She has a lot of research done on it, and a lot of the places are real, and it tells in the book where those places are now. And also, I love Louis L'Amour.
Oh, wow.
And
yeah.
also Zane Grey.
A couple of old classic Western writers there. Nice to hear from you, Crystal. Thanks for that. And rereading the whole series of a book is something I had not heard before in the callers we've had so far. And Clay, that takes that whole idea of time and really expands it out. But if you've got the time, it'd be worth it.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is what it all comes down to, is just if you have the commitment on the one hand, but also just the time to go back and say, okay, instead of reading this week's well-reviewed book in the New York Times Book Review, I'm going to go back to this other book that I read a few years ago. I think it's a tough choice that a lot of people have to make, but going back to a classic is just, or a personal classic can be really rewarding.
Let's take a final call. Connie is with us from Williams Bay. Hi, Connie.
Hi there. Great show. I just caught the tail end, but I wanted to share with you a real unusual phenomenon that I've experienced as an adult when I've revisited favorite children's stories or stories that I read when I was a kid. Specifically, I'm thinking about the Little House series, or a previous caller had mentioned Little Women, Secret Garden. I completely dislike them as an adult, and I'm not exactly sure why that is, but it has almost ruined my perception of some of those favorite children's books. So as an adult, I've reread other titles, but when I kind of revisit those children's titles, that's the same for me.
Oh, man. So have you just taken yourself out of the rereading game altogether, Connie?
For children's books.
I see.
Books, but like I said, some of those, I remember loving The Secret Garden when I was a girl, but when I revisited it as an adult, not so much.
Well, Connie, thanks for that. And Clay Risen, have you gone back to revisit any of those Hardy Boys books?
Not very good books, but I hope that people don't take that experience or Connie's experience and think that means these books are horrible in an absolute sense. There is something to be said for the way that children engage with books like this, and there's a value there, even if we as adults don't quite get it. I think that you can't discount the way that children can have a relationship with a text, even not a particularly good text, but just one that sings to them in a way. And they may not be able to express it. We may not be able to appreciate it. But when you see a kid going back and back to a book, no matter what you think of it, I think you have to appreciate that.
Well, Clay, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today, and thanks for your column.
Well, thanks for having me.
That was Clay Risen, editor at the New York Times op-ed section. We've been talking, and his new book is The Bill of the Century, The Epic Battle for the Civil Rights Act. We've been talking about his piece that he wrote about the joys of rereading, and you'll find that posted on our Central Time Facebook page. And Rob, you like to reread, right?
Just one series, and Rachel on Facebook nailed it, as did one of our callers. Rachel says, I've also reread George R. R. Martin's Song of Ice and Fire. She says, I watched the show version, Game of Thrones. It makes me want to reread it again because the books are so much better. Gene, I'm not as big a rereader as you are, but with this Game of Thrones series, I'll be like, oh, I'll kill a little time, I'll read a chapter. Mm-hmm. Oh, now I'm going to follow this character, and before I know it, I'm like rereading all five books again. So that one, for some reason, is one that sucks me in. Hearing you and Clay talk about this, I think I want to start rereading some others, and maybe some more serious stuff.
It's a great way to go. I am a compulsive rereader, and so I actually have to. I have the opposite issue where I have to work hard to read new stuff because I get. I know it's a challenge, but it's a lot of fun, and it's a great story and a great piece. Check it out on our Facebook page. Coming up in just a moment, we'll find out about an effort to get Wisconsin State Parks spruced up just in time for Earth Day.
First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Many animals have evolved the ability to feign death. Writer Jill Sisson Quinn witnessed this unusual act of survival in a groundhog.
One day, a groundhog scampered through my yard from pine to pine, as if the pines were bases in a game of tag, putting a paw on each one. Halfway to the bird feeder, our eyes met. And although I would have joyfully watched him enact some clumsily acrobatic sunflower seed thievery that surely over time I would regret, he changed his mind and ran away. A week later, I stopped before a lean-to of 2x4s in the barn. Behind it hid the groundhog, looking very wild amongst all that planed wood. One day, as I moved the garden hose, there came the rasp of a threatened animal. In the yard stood my dog and the groundhog, nose to nose. The groundhog was not running, but sticking it out strongly. They circled eye to eye, opponents in a wrestling match before the first move. There was much hissing and lunging. Afraid of bites, I called my husband, who emerged from the barn with a canoe paddle, as if he could draw them apart as easily as a boat from shore. But the ferry had already left. The groundhog collapsed rigidly right in front of the dog's bared teeth. She was no longer Betsy, but Cerberus, the three-headed dog who guarded the entrance to Hades. I'd read of high-stress animals like shrews dying from fright alone. My dog, unprovoked, followed me to the house for water. "It's dying," my husband said when I returned. We stared at it, all four black paws in the air, as if it had donned gloves for its own funeral. A fly was already encircling one of its toes. If we knew anything about rigor mortis, we might have seen through its high-speed act. To let it die in peace, my husband headed to the house and I to the garden. But a moment later, the groundhog was gone. Groundhogs don't commonly play possum, though the ability to feign death has evolved in many species. I'm fascinated by this act of survival, part psychology, part art, so contrary to everything a body stands for, so brave and beautiful and smart. Most predators aren't scavengers, and scavengers aren't predators at all. Do the last thing a predator expects, and he won't want to eat you. Then rise before buzzards start circling. It's almost enough to make you believe eating isn't as important as the chase itself, that being eaten is a reasonable price for the opportunity to play a convincing part. A sort of animal Olympics, an animal academy awards. Predator and prey turned athlete and thespian. Essayist Scott Russell Sanders writes, "If we are ever going to dwell in the house of the Lord, I believe we do so now. If any house is divinely made, it is this one here, this great whirling mansion of planets and stars." I agree. It was on my own 2 acres where I witnessed the resurrection, after all. And like most spirits, the little groundhog disappeared after he performed his miracle. I haven't seen him again, but he has left me with faith and wonder.
Jill Sisson Quinn is a writer in central Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik and is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org or search for Wisconsin Life on Facebook.
With Earth Day right around the corner, many are eager to give a little bit back to the land in whatever way they can. Two groups in Wisconsin have a suggestion.
The Wisconsin DNR and Friends of Wisconsin State Parks are hosting a series of events called Work, Play, Earth Day. It's designed to get volunteers out to their local state park to help clean up and to make some improvements before the busy summer season gets underway.
Joining us now in the studio to tell us more about the event is Roger Putnam, president of Friends of Wisconsin State Parks. Roger, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, what was the inspiration for Work, Play, Earth Day?
Well, of course, we all try to live the life of every day is Earth Day, right? So it certainly isn't enough to just have one day for Earth Day. So we have Earth Day Month, if you will. So this was born about 6 years ago, where we, you know, really did not feel that one day was quite enough, one weekend was quite enough. So it's expanded happily. In the last 6 years, it's doubled in size. So we now have 3 weekends devoted to the, you know, getting out to the parks, joining existing friends groups in the parks, and doing what you can to help out. So, you know, as much as we're enjoying the nice warm weather today, we actually had to cancel one of the activities in one of the northern parks this weekend because they had about 6 inches of snow. So that was kind of a drag.
Well, it is still Wisconsin. But in terms of what people can expect if they'd like to get out and help out, what sort of work are we talking about when we're helping to get the parks ready for summer?
Fun work, Gene. Really fun work.
So let's say that again. Fun work. Okay.
Really fun. I mean, pretty much what you'd expect. Raking, clearing trails, getting campsites ready, painting, planting. There's a lot of the kids that come out. I mean, that's what's so fun about these events is just the multi-generational approach to it. So you've got a lot of Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and, you know, high school classes, middle school classes coming out and joining with, you know, senior citizens who are, you know, really the backbone of a lot of the work that goes on in our parks these days. And, you know, just it's a fun day. So, you know, there's a number of ways to access the information. I mean, there's a long list of parks. We had five properties over last weekend. We've got 11 coming up this weekend. And then the final weekend of Work Play is the whatever the May 3rd weekend, and that there's four parks there. So if you want more information, I definitely encourage you to go to either the DNR website or fwsp.org. That's fwsp.org.
Now, this is a rough winter for us humans. Did it take a toll on our parks, too? Do they need extra work because of the winter?
You know, absolutely. I wish I could say I've been out to them so far, but as you all know, the snow was upon us just this last week. So, but yeah, it's been a very tough winter on all fronts, and particularly our state parks. You know, the state parks they need a lot of attention, you know, under the best of conditions. So, that's the role of the Friends of Wisconsin State Parks, and we love working with the DNR and helping them get the job done.
Now, when you're taking a look, obviously you can't get to every state park as part of this. Do you pick out the ones that are busy or see the most use or need the most work, or how do you identify the sites that you work on?
Well, it really starts with where there is a motivated and robust individual friends group. So, you know, Buckhorn or a Devil's Lake or a Peninsula, Lakeshore in Milwaukee. I mean, these are groups that are active no matter what. And so it really starts there. And their ability to, you know, at its core, they're going to be there. And so so we try to encourage others to join them so that you really all you have to do is show up, maybe have some work gloves and inspiration, and the rest is pretty much laid out for you. It's a lot of fun, and there's always food there and, you know, games, and it's quite an event.
So this is important. I don't need to know anything or how to do anything, and I can still show up and be useful?
That's right.
Okay. So even a radio host could do this. Even a radio host could do this, I guess. So you hosted the first set of events last Saturday. Some of it was snowed out, sounds like. But beyond that, for the places where you were able to have a turnout, how'd that go?
It was great. We've had just record turnouts. As I had said, the program itself has doubled in size. We're seeing, I mean, the first weekend again was the big weekend is this weekend. So it's the most parks. It's the time that is really closest to Earth Day. So that's when we really expect the most turnout. But I think we were trying to do the math when I was coming over here. It's something in the neighborhood of 750 to 800 people, volunteers coming out to the parks during the course of this these 3 weeks. And they just they really make a big difference, planting flowers, trees. So when people really start to hit the parks at the end of May, they're all gussied up and ready to go.
Bigger picture, what do we in Wisconsin gain by having a well-kept, well-maintained state park system?
Well, I mean, the recreation aspect, the fitness aspect, families being together, gaining a keener appreciation for the environment. I mean, one of the things that we're trying to do at FWSP is really do a much better job of getting into the cities and getting a more, getting some of the urban folks more interested in just appreciating the outdoors, things that they can do, help show them, folks that wouldn't normally get out to parks, how to appreciate them. And so that's really going to be one of the things we're going to try to do a lot better job of. And I know the DNR is interested in doing the same thing.
Now, you did just mention that if people are interested in volunteering, you don't need any particular skills to do that. Just show up and people will point you in the right direction. But if people want to get involved, do they have to register ahead of time? Do they just show up at the park and come ready to work? Or how does that work?
Well, Gene, yeah, you really can just show up. And you can show up. Generally speaking, people start in the morning, 9 o'clock, and work most of the day. So you really can just it's really almost refreshing that you can just show up somewhere without a pass or a ID and just say, what can I do? And somebody will be glad to point in the direction of a wheelbarrow or a plat of plants and get you going.
Now, if someone can't make it to one of these events, or they do and they get a taste for this and they say, hey, I want to do this on a regular basis, is there room for that? Are there volunteers at parks who do things throughout the season?
I love Rob. He's a great setup man, right, Jane? absolutely. I mean, if you really want to get involved, go to our website, fwsp.org, and look for the park nearest you. And I guarantee you there's an organization in existence. We've got more than 80 individual friends groups. And, we're working year-round at either raising money or identifying projects, working with the DNR. So it's a year-round labor of love.
And in the future, I mean, you've mentioned this has doubled in, what, 6 years?
Correct.
And you're hoping to see that happen again in 2 years, 4 years?
Well, I tell you, in general, our organization is just really trying to get a lot more aggressive in outreach and getting the word out so that more people can enjoy parks. We're at historic levels now of people. I forget how many millions, 13 million people are enjoying state parks now. So the more the merrier. I know that there's always a concern about, overuse, but I don't think we're anywhere near that. And it's just a great way to enjoy life.
Roger, briefly before we let you go, what's the next park you're looking forward to visiting, not on a working basis?
Well, it's funny. We have our annual or one of our quarterly meetings at Bong State Park, which is an interesting name. But so that's our next stop. We have a regional meeting there where we have other friends groups coming in and share their thoughts so we can do a better job to help parks.
Well, Roger, thanks so much for being here today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Roger Putnam is the president of Friends of Wisconsin State Parks. We've got a link to the Work, Play, Earth Day events and to the list of participating state parks on the Central Time Facebook page.